Bienvenidos and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. Bienvenidos to all you listeners in all 118 countries where the Jacobin Sports Show is heard. I am your host, Matthew Miranda, enjoying one endless day of summer vacation. I am on Long Island now for the rest of July because the class I'm teaching is on campus on Long Island. I drove down over the weekend to get here. And today is like the one day where I just had a free day to do like anything. And the weather's been perfect. I've watched more TV than I have, like new things in like all year. There's an anime called Zom 100, which is this really cool show about a Japanese guy who's like basically being worked to death at his job, and he hates it, and he's overworked and he's abused, and the zombie apocalypse comes and he's like elated because the apocalypse means he doesn't have to go to work anymore, and like that's how much he hates his job. And it's really beautifully animated. Like literally the animations becomes black and white as he gets beaten down more and more at work, and then as these zombies show up and start killing everybody, like all of a sudden color starts popping back. And it's bright and vibrant. It's very lovely. I saw This Is the End, which I had not seen before. Seth Rogen movie. It's very much a Seth Rogen movie. So it had laughs. And Peter Jackson did a documentary called They Shall Not Grow Old. This is all on Netflix. It's a compilation of film from World War I, documentary film, that has been at times colorized and enhanced with like sound effects and things, but it's all the words of people who were there going through it then. And he takes you from before the war from the perspective of the British. He takes you from, you know, kids 15 or 16 sneaking their way into the army with the British knowing that they were too young, up until going overseas, getting their first taste of battle life in the trenches. It's really well done and very interesting. I feel I should give you a quick allusion to the last episode and then a preview of this one and then a preview of the next one. So if you didn't hear last episode, it was about breaking up with Major League Baseball. All the reasons why Major League Baseball has basically lost me after a very long time as a fan. The next episode next week seems to be coming together. And if it does, it's going to focus on the different lived experiences of people and the rhythms of a sporting season. So I'm going to have a fan on of a team whose season went much longer than expected. And what is it like as that happens? And then when it ends, what is the crash like? I may have someone on whose team had their season end kind of abruptly and disappointingly, and I want to get their feelings on what that is like emotionally, and what the shape of your life looks like when you commit nights for months and months and months. You invest in this team and this narrative, and then it's done. And I also have a media figure who has been on the show before. Howard Beck has agreed to return, NBA insider and expert. But I want to talk to Beck specifically about his experience as someone in the media and someone who covers a league that is no longer — every league used to have an off season or a quiet time, and like the NBA certainly does not anymore. So I want to talk to people and get a sense of like how your actual lived experience is impacted by when these seasons end or don't end. As for this episode, this is just a fun little sampler plate of different stories going on in and around the world of sports. The one that caught my eye the most, actually this news dropped today, Monday, when the New York Times announced that it's shutting down its sports section and turning over all of its coverage from now on regarding sports to The Athletic. Kind of sad news if you have followed the Times, or particularly if you are someone who relies on its archives. The Times has been, you know, on the pulse of so many major American sports stories forever. For them to be now kind of bowing out of the business is, I don't know if it's meaning, I don't know how meaningful the one, this one story is, but it, as part of a larger pattern, you know, this is happening because of money, and it's happening because of people making decisions about money and decisions who don't need any more money and aren't really trustworthy with decisions. And it just seems like less of a rich world that there is not a New York Times sports section in addition to The Athletic. Oddly, this kind of transference of coverage from The Times to The Athletic does not necessarily mean that there will be expansion at The Athletic or that business is even good there. Remember that it was only a month ago that The Athletic fired 4% of its newsroom staff. You're kind of seeing this. It happens all over sports media. You know, ESPN announces they're going to fire 7%. Everybody else starts firing 7%. Vox, which runs SB Nation, if you go on Vox now, their NBA page, for example, if you go to NBA at the top of Vox and you hit the drop down, one of the things that was nice about SB Nation for many years is that as an NBA fan, every single NBA team had an SB Nation page. So if you're a fan of one team, but you really wanted to get a sense of like, okay, like I know what the media says about the Charlotte Hornets or the Golden State Warriors, but like, what are the fans who actually follow the team? Like, what are they talking about? And what are they expressing in comment sections? And you can go to any team in the league, any of the 30. It was a great way to learn about other teams. It was a great way to learn about differences between sometimes how national media would view a story versus what the actual local people and the actual hardcore fans of the team thought. SB Nation built its entire empire as a site on a very vibrant comment section. And now when you go on SB Nation, if you go to the dropdown on the NBA, there's a lot of teams gone now. I would guess at least a third of the league doesn't appear to have an SB Nation page. For the teams who are absent, for example, the Chicago Bulls have had for years one of the more vibrant sites and communities called Bloggable. Bloggable now has gone to Substack. A lot of the teams that are no longer listed on SB Nation's NBA page have Substacks. So this is happening all over sports media. Unsaid in the announcement today, but impossible to miss, the fact that the New York Times sports department was unionized. The Athletic is not. So in this very nice, clever move by the Times, they have transferred some things around, and they have also managed in the meantime to get rid of an entire unionized force and replace them with one that is not unionized, which is kind of weird. I'm a little distracted, sorry. My phone is in the other room. Give me 5 seconds. I don't know how to pause this recording, and the phone is driving me nuts, so just give me 5 seconds. And we're back. So I was distracted by the phone. It's not weird. I should certainly not say that it's weird. It's completely what you would expect from a company run by people who are making decisions that have nothing to do with the public good in mind. David Roth had an excellent article today in Defector, kind of along these lines. He was writing about, oh my God, I never remember how to say this person's name. He wrote a piece called "They Don't Want Us and We Don't Need Them." And it's about the guy who just killed an article at GQ that he did not like written about himself, David Zaslav. And at the end of Ross' article, he has this beautiful extended quote that I will read to you. He says, at some point, there has to be a parting of ways. If what the market demands diverges not just from what people want, but from what they can actually bear, the answer would seem to be to get on with making something else. There is no reason that the people who made this moment and who are currently rushing to put up fences and turnstiles everywhere they can really need to be a part of whatever is next. They own a lot, but the value doesn't come from them. At this point, everyone has seen the shape of their ambitions and their limitations. It is clear that, in some fundamental ways, they have nothing to do with us. These people that Roth is writing about, I call them 1%, the powers that be, the haves, management, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's much more complicated, I think, than just saying management, or much more diverse than just saying management. But these are not people to just be written off as, you know, a mere gripe, like they're noisy neighbors or something. These people are world ruiners. They ruin people's world. They ruin our world. And you wonder when you see, and obviously, in a lot of senses, does it matter one way or the other with everything going on in the world if the New York Times has a sports section or not? No, but the reason the New York Times no longer has a unionized sports section is not because it makes 99% of our lives any better. And it's another example of something that happens that makes you wonder how far can the rich continue to squeeze the life out of everything before everything starts to squeeze back. So it is kind of, to me, a sad story a little bit, coming from the Times. More for, I just think, what it says. It's like that submersible story. It's not so much the actual event that is significant. Like, the submersible story was a big deal, not because, oh my God, like, these five people are so important to all of us. I think it was significant to a lot of people because what was happening, both in what led them to the danger and then the response to it, was a microcosm of how life on this planet works today. You had these people who took all of these risks, did all of this unethical, irresponsible, potentially illegal behavior to cut corners so they could make more money than the obscene amount they already have. And when it backfired, how much time and resources and people and money were expended seeing if they could save them, when every day in Europe, there was just another story the other day of there's 200 migrants who are missing at sea from Senegal. The submersible story was a bigger deal than the submersible story because it was kind of a canary in the coal mine. That's the wrong metaphor, but it's a microcosm of something larger. And the story with the Times, like, are these people really going to suffer? According to the Times, no one's being laid off. They're all going to be funneled into other, you know, parts of the paper. And like, okay, maybe you dreamed your whole life of being a sports writer, and now instead you're writing about business at the New York Times. It's not your dream, but it's very much like a first world problem. But it's also, again, another indication, I think that one is a canary in the coal mine kind of thing, of this is the kind of thing that keeps happening, multiplied by billions of daily events around the world, that just doesn't feel good. And that feels like, oh, something else is getting worse. Is that ever going to stop? Interesting story out of Las Vegas last week. The NBA began its annual summer league competition, which is predominantly made up of rookies and either second year players or youngsters who are trying to basically audition for an NBA spot, or in a lot of cases, show a G League team or an international team that they have the chops to make it on their squad. A bizarre story out of the Vegas League, which the big story was supposed to be and was the debut of Victor Wembanyama, the, depending on how you measure him, 7'4" or 7'5" wunderkid who was drafted number one by the Spurs this year. He's supposed to be the greatest prospect since LeBron James. He can do things at his size, his handle, his passing. He literally does things no one has seen before. He makes plays no one has seen before because he is the most athletic 7'4/7'5" human being probably since Goliath. So of course, the big story out of his debut is not so much the debut as the fact that after the game, Britney Spears tried to get his attention from behind. And when she tapped him, his security detail, I guess this is standard protocol, but when someone puts a hand on their guy, they just get rid of the hand. And there was a dispute about whether or not, first, the allegation was that the guards had hit Spears in the face. Then, according to Wembanyama's camp, and maybe video, it seemed that Spears might have accidentally hit herself in the face. She said she's waiting for an apology. Wembanyama did not sound like he was going to be offering one for himself or for his people. My only interest in this story is that it seems to confirm that the singularity, like the singularity is real, and this is the event horizon. That, like, we're at a point where everything really is just kind of approaching a singular moment. When Britney Spears is a lead story on NBA Twitter because of this random collision she has with the next big thing. And then it led to, like, Wembanyama got dunked on by Kai Jones of Charlotte, and all these Britney Spears fans were posting like little videos of Jones dunking on Wembanyama to the music from, like, Hit Me Baby One More Time. Very, that's the most 2023 I can think of. Like, that tells me that we're headed somewhere that I don't understand when Victor Wembanyama and Britney Spears have somehow crossed streams. The other thing that stood out to me about the Wembanyama debut, not the game itself, his debut was last Friday night. That night, I was in a hotel room in Liberty, New York, decompressing after day one of a 2-day drive. I'm in my hotel room. I'm just crashed on the bed, chilling. Wembanyama's game is going to be on TV. I'm a big NBA fan. I didn't watch a single second of it. I watched the Mets instead, which raises 2 points. One, the Mets, you may be asking, given that last episode was about breaking up with Major League Baseball. All I can tell you is, you know how with some breakups, the sex is harder to let go of than the other stuff? That is the deal here. It's very easy to give up on the Mets as ever, again, meaning what they used to. I know the spark is gone. It's long gone. But some sensations are harder to give up than others. The Mets were on a little bit of a winning streak. And really, it's less about the Mets than the other realization I made, which is that I think for the first time in my life ever, I have hit a saturation point with the NBA. I cannot imagine investing any more time or energy in what is such an obviously meaningless part of the season. Now, there is stuff you can always talk about if you want to, and God knows people do it. There's always something that people can talk about with the NBA. I've been a big NBA fan my whole life. I don't know if it's my age now and that things have changed, that my life has changed in a way where there's just other room to follow it. I don't know if it's writing and potting so much about it requires investing all this attention. And so now that I don't have to be talking about it so much, I just want an escape. I'm not sure what it is, but you know what Victor Wembanyama did against a bunch of dudes in Las Vegas, most of whom won't be in the NBA this year or ever, I could not care less. And there was a certain relief in knowing, like, this event is happening and everybody's talking about it, and I'm not there. I want a break from it. I need a break from it. So I have nothing to say about his debut because this is a meaningless time of year. It's a good, healthy thing for people to have meaningless times of year. Everything should not matter. God, it's exhausting. Speaking of exhausting, the other maybe dominant NBA story of late has been this standoff between Damian Lillard and the Portland Trailblazers. Lillard has spent the last 11 seasons in Portland. He has always been happy to be there, loyal about being there, has stood out as being one of the NBA's only great players who has vocally avoided like pushing his way to a better team or a contender. Portland really hasn't been a contender most of the years that he's been there, especially the last few years, but they've had a lot of good memories. He's had huge moments in the playoffs. But now there's this divide where Lillard has announced that he wants to be traded, and he's been clear, as has his agent, that he wants to be traded to one place, which is Miami. Portland has a new general manager, and Portland's general manager has been very clear that he doesn't care really about Dame wanting to go to Miami. He's going to do what he thinks is best for the Blazers and get the best trade package he can, which obviously causes a lot of turmoil, because now our team's going to want to trade for Lillard if they have the sense that he doesn't want to come there because he has his heart set on Miami. Lillard's agent made the unusual step of responding to a media member asking him about whether he had talked to teams, and he basically said frankly right out, like, yeah, I've told other teams that he wants to go to Miami. Like, he's very much trying to steer himself in one direction, and it seemed like for a while the organization would be on the same page with him. It's kind of been a little surprising how adamant Portland right now sounds. Maybe that's just to protect trade value, but they're definitely putting out all the signs that, yeah, no, we're not doing this to enable you. We're doing this to make ourselves better. What interests me about this story is the fan erasure that goes on in it. It's, again, one of these stories where the people are expected to pick a side between two parties who are so outside of their lived experience. Like, here you have a dispute between a billionaire, Blazers owner Jody Allen, who's worth $20 billion, and a millionaire. Lillard earned $235 million over those first 11 years in Portland. He is due $215 million the next four alone, assuming he picks up a player option in the fourth year for $60 million when he's 36, which he will. And all the thousandaires, all the regular people, are supposed to sit on the sideline and pick a side and make it a binary, as if they have no interest in what comes next, as if they're not the fundamental force in all of this. The reason Jody Allen has a basketball team to run that has picked up in value over and over the years, the reason Damian Lillard has been financially successful and beloved, is because of the fans in Portland. And now the story is being framed as owner versus player. But Lillard's going to be 33 next year. One way or the other, he is going to no longer be a meaningful part of the Blazers' present or future in probably 2 or 3 years. Maybe 3 to 4 years, whatever. But within 5 years, he's not going to be a factor. Jody Allen has wanted to sell the team for a while. Paul Allen, her husband, owned the team. He passed away. Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike, wants to buy the team. Allen does not want to sell to Phil Knight for reasons. The fans are the constant, though. The fans are the ones. Jody Allen and Dame Lillard could both have nothing to do with the Blazers by 2028. But the fans, the ones who were there in the 70s when they, you know, had Bill Walton, and were there in the 80s and 90s with the Clyde Drexler teams, and were there in the 2000s with the Brandon Roy teams and the Jailblazers, and then bounced back with Lillard and LaMarcus Aldridge, and who are there now with Jeremy Grant and Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe, those people, the story is presented as if they are, you know, background, that they really aren't a part of this. I get tired of that. Speaking of things that I'm tired of, we spoke a few weeks ago about the WNBA's failing Brittany Griner by having her in a position in an airport to be exposed to harassment from some asshole, because the WNBA, this global leader in women's basketball, can't pull together $25 million so all their teams can fly. Jesus, I never remember what it's called. The opposite of coach, charter. So Doug Feinberg is a writer for the AP. He recently traveled with the Liberty to get a sense of what it's like for these professional athletes, many of whom are super tall, to travel, given that they often fly coach. Some of Feinberg's conclusions in a piece that he wrote for the AP. The Liberty traveled from Connecticut to Las Vegas recently for a game. From the time they had all of their luggage in the hotel lobby in Connecticut ready to go to the airport until they actually touched down in Las Vegas for their to prepare for a game against the best team in the league, the Aces, it took 12 hours. Part of the reason, the team can't always be processed quickly and uniformly because while a lot of the players are cleared for TSA pre-check status, international players are not allowed that status. So Jonquel Jones is from the Bahamas. Marine Johannes is French. So they sometimes have to wait and go through normal security just like everybody else does, which holds the team up. I talked about this last time. I do not understand for the life of me how a league predominantly run by billionaires cannot find $2 million per team so they can fly the same way other professional basketball teams do. Feinberg wrote in his piece, I did not know this, that WNBA players are allowed to bump up to first class. Sorry, there's a couple of dogs here that I'm dog sitting and they found something outside to bark at. Sorry about that. WNBA allows its players to bump up to first class if the player will foot the bill. Like, come on. What are you doing with these people? It is absolutely absurd that the WNBA fined Josiah a few years ago $500,000 because they found out he was flying the team charter. And you can't do that because we can't have one team flying that way unless all the teams can fly that way. But literally, the fine was a quarter of what it would cost for Psy to fund that for the whole year. You look ridiculous punishing the owners that you have who are trying to professionalize your industry. And I know we all care about competitive integrity, but you're trying to grow and develop a league. And my God, how can you not figure this out? How can you not find some way to make this work? Because I don't think they care deep down. Which I think does lead into the next story. Positive news out of WNBA and worker initiative and power everywhere. Two WNBA players, Brianna Stewart of the Liberty and Nafisa Collier of the Minnesota Lynx, just announced that they have founded a new league, a new women's basketball league called Unrivaled. It is meant to give WNBA players a domestic option so that they can stay stateside during the offseason and make enough money for this to be worth it, versus till now the reality that if they wanted to really survive financially, most of them had to go overseas and spend their offseason overseas to do so. So Unrivaled will hopefully give more and more players a chance to make money and stay here. The league will run from January through March. It has currently six franchises. Each team will have five players because it's not a regular five-on-five competition. There'll be three-on-three and one-on-one games. And one of the things that this Unrivaled League is meant to help prevent is what happened to Gabby Williams, who was a player on the Seattle Storm. Gabby Williams spent her last offseason in France playing for Lyon Feminine. That actually put her in danger of being able to return to the Seattle Storm because the WNBA made a new rule this year, the prioritization rule, which requires any player with two or more years of experience to report to their WNBA teams for training camp or risk being suspended for the entire season with no pay. So you're too cheap to get the players to stay here, and now you're going to punish them further financially if they're not able to leave the teams who pay them sometimes much better than what they make here to be back in time. This reeks of, and a lot of you know this feeling, You got a bank account and you're poor. Something goes wrong. You bounce a check or there's some kind of fee you're not expecting. And the next thing you know, now the bank is punishing you for being poor. In this case, we have the WNBA forcing players to go overseas, forcing people like Brittany Griner to put themselves in a dangerous position, forcing a player like Gabby Williams to have to make difficult decisions that she shouldn't have to be making because she's trying to balance, well, I could make this here and what about this there, but I don't want to get suspended there. In fact, Williams suffered a concussion in April while she was in France in a Euro Cup game. She had been planning to play for France in the Eurobasket tournament in June, but because of the concussion, she missed the tournament. That and that alone is why she was able to get back to Seattle in time for the season now. And Williams said, quote, I still think the prioritization thing is ridiculous. I'm sorry, I'll say it. I'm only here, meaning Seattle, because I got concussed. Something has to give. France needs to have shorter seasons, or the WNBA needs to allow players to make money and do both. She's right. It's not happening, but she is right. Lastly, there was once a great show way back in the day, I think in the very early 1990s, called Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Barcelona football is the Parker Lewis of global football. They cannot lose. Barcelona 2 weeks ago made this extraordinary announcement at a board meeting where they announced that Barcelona has been $1.5 billion in debt going back a couple of years now. They were a team who were, they were taking some financial risks that the pandemic really exacerbated. Because a lot of the things that Barcelona depended on to support their enormous expenses, just like with the rest of the world, got screwed up by the pandemic. They've been $1.5 billion in debt since then. As a result, there are limitations on things that they can do because of the rules in the Spanish league, La Liga. You know, they're not allowed, for example, in La Liga, you sign a player, but then the player has to be registered to officially be eligible to play in the league. And if you're not meeting the league's financial standards, you won't be allowed to register a player. So Barca has had problems the last couple of years where they've had to, at times, have current players renegotiate their contracts down, trade players away who came to Barcelona because that's where they wanted to play, but they had to do it to try to clear some payroll to sign, to register the new players. So 2 weeks ago at a board meeting, club executives announced that they are putting their own personal finances on the line to ensure that Barca receives a $7.5 million bank guarantee. All this info it comes from a writer named Paul Balus, who writes in The Athletic. That $7.5 million bank guarantee was necessary for Barcelona to sign players this summer. La Liga gives each team a salary limit that they have to meet. Barca were told that they have to offload over $200 million in salary to be financially compliant. Somehow, by La Liga math, getting rid of $200 million in salary when you're $1.5 billion in debt will allow Barcelona to spend $400 to $500 million on new players. You can try to make sense of this math all you want. I'm sure there's a sense and a math and a logic to it. But when you put it that way, a team that has been $1.5 billion in debt for multiple years, if they get rid of $200 million in salary, they are allowed to spend 2 to 2.5 times that. Doesn't make sense in any world where sense matters. Take the case for Barcelona this offseason of Ilkay Gundogan. Barcelona signed, Gundogan has been a brilliant player the last few years for Manchester City. He's on the wrong side of 30, but is still such a great player. And he agreed to go to Barcelona. But because Barcelona, they have signed him to a free transfer, but they still haven't registered him because they haven't hit the financial benchmarks that they have to be eligible to register him yet. He has a clause in his contract that says if he's not registered by September 1st, Gundogan can leave Barcelona and receive the entirety of his first year's salary. This is where things are at now with Barcelona. There is something so... I've said this before, I'm sure, on the show. There is something so extremely old world and old money about all the hype and griping over Manchester City and their finances, despite 15 years of evidence on the field, off the field, that this is one of the best-run clubs in global sport. Constantly sued by UEFA, sued, being now taken to court by the Premier League itself. And meanwhile, Barcelona fall into an absolutely epic, stupid amount of debt. And yet, they're an old power. They are, you want to make a global, all-time Mount Rushmore of football clubs? Barcelona's there, no question. Barcelona and Madrid, unquestionably both there. So they can continue to sign players. They continue to participate in the Champions League, no problems. They continue to participate in La Liga, no problems. No questions asked. No derision directed their way. It's just, God, it bothers me so much. If Man City was, you know, whatever, it's not about Man City, but so Barcelona, you know what, with all the debt they were in last year, they were able to sign a bunch of players. They added Robert Lewandowski, one of the best strikers in the world. They won La Liga. They're just still able to keep marching on despite the fact that they're $1.5 billion in debt and continue to be $1.5 billion in debt. Like, it's not like things have gotten better. They're just consistently drowning. And still, life is good for Barcelona. So may we all be that fortunate. That's all for this episode of the Jacobin Sports Show. Please follow us, if you don't, on Twitter, at Jacobin Sports. I'll be honest, I've slacked off on the Jacobin Sports Twitter page. You can follow me, if you don't, Matt, at Matthew E. Miranda. Email any questions you have about the show, any thoughts, to jacobinsports@gmail.com. I'm now going to sing to you a little song I wrote to the tune of Lonesome Town by Ricky Nelson, which you can find on the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. Subscribe today to Great Writing with takes that aren't local. Patreon.com/Jacobin Sports Show. That's all for this episode. Please stay tuned next week. I think it's going to be a good one. That's all for now, everybody. Peace.